Thorny Arneson, our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And of course, you know, we're recording on Tuesday morning. I start with a quote, and I keep thinking, what quote would I start with? Someone I know posted these two very short, pithy quotes on his Facebook page. He's kind of this interesting young rebel that I've known since he was about 10. And here are the two quotes for the day. The race of a cop is cop. Let me read that again. The race of a cop is cop. That's a quote by Bakari Sellers. And then this is an even maybe very interesting one by a fellow by the name of Jason Sole, I think, or Sole, S-O-L-E. He lives right now in Minnesota. He's formerly incarcerated, and now he's a professor. So he's come a full arc. And here's what he wrote. All your skin folk ain't kin folk. Obviously, you know what I'm talking about with what just happened recently in Memphis. Before I introduce my guest, so I was just sitting there and I was thinking and I was thinking. And then it suddenly occurred to me that the most powerful white supremacist in America is Clarence Thomas. Think about what he's done on the court. Think of what the court is doing with their quote-unquote originalism, white men telling everybody else what to do and treating blacks as, you know, three-quarters people or three-fifths people and telling women they don't have rights. And they go back there and you saw what happened with abortion. You know what he's threatening on so many other levels. And the right to privacy is something he doesn't believe in. And I suddenly realized to a large extent, in some ways, he is exactly that. Anyway, as we contemplate that, let me then go to one of my absolute favorite sources of information, which is theconversation.com. And as my audience knows, I go there all the time. You know I go there because they talk to professors and PhD candidates from not just America, but from around the world. So it's incredibly valuable. And one of the reasons I like to go there is not only do they write about interesting topics that not necessarily are getting the attention of the media, but these are the people the media go to quote. So I thought, well, let's cut out the middleman. Let's just go straight to them. And so that's exactly what I did. The title of the article was Rural Americans Aren't Included in Inflation Figures. And for them, the cost of living may be rising faster. A point of personal privilege, I raised my children in rural New Hampshire, a town of 1,200 people. We had, I think, two stop signs, no stoplight. We had to go very far to go to a grocery store. There wasn't daycare available. We had a tiny, tiny little school system, a K through 12 for 1,200 people, which meant sometimes the classes were as big as 12. It was difficult to find a job, and you had to spend a lot of money on gas in order to get there. Having raised my children in that rural environment, I understood the headline. But then when I went into the article, the numbers were familiar, but I didn't know them. So let me introduce one of the authors of this piece about rural America. Tessa Conroy is an economic development specialist at the University of Wisconsin at Madison Extension. She studies community economic growth and development, small business dynamics, and women entrepreneurs. Let me welcome Tessa to the program. Thank you, Tessa, so much for doing this.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm going to start with this question. Is it intentional that the Federal Reserve goes to sort of the urban environment to sort of put together the data about inflation? Is it just that it's easier? It's just that they get bigger numbers? Do they do this, or do they weight things as they look at inflation and the effects of inflation? Because we know that they sort of pull together sort of a pool of different products to look at, different services to look at. And based on that, that's how they set the inflation numbers. And the problem is, from your article, it sounds like there may be some very different numbers when you look in one environment than another. And I guess my question is, so how does the Federal Reserve actually establish their parameters? And why do they not distinguish between urban and rural America?
That's a great question. And, you know, I don't know the answer into how we got to this place where we're not looking more closely at what's happening to prices in rural areas and what that means for rural households. We do get most people with the current method of serving urban areas. We get over 80% of the population. So my sense is that we do our best to get most people. And then we hope that what we see in urban areas is pretty close to what we see in rural areas and make some sort of policy adjustments based on that. But as we point out in the article, that can be potentially problematic to the extent that rural areas, as we know, are different in a lot of ways than urban places. These places are different demographically. They are different in their day-to-day living patterns in ways that really matter for their spending habits and how inflation might be impacting them.
You know, everything I do, I also look through the lens of politics. And I'm just, you know, I describe myself as a politician in recovery. Please forgive me, Tessa. So as I'm thinking about this, and you talk about that, you know, 80% of America may be living in these more urban, suburban areas, a very small percentage of the population is living in rural areas. And then I look at the map. And right. I look at the counties. And I look at the fact that the vast majority of the map is red and looks and appears to be not only more Republican and conservative in nature, but nobody looks at the density in those red areas, but the swath of red areas covers virtually, it feels like almost the entire country. So while we are looking at pockets of intensity, which is the urban and suburban area, what we fail to do is then look at what is happening. And when you recognize, for example, whether you're a rural state like Wyoming or an urban state like New York, you both get two senators. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face to allow the Federal Reserve to make what appears to be an easy and obvious decision about looking at where, you know, the greatest majority of people live, and therefore let's figure out the inflation numbers, when you recognize that there's a cause and effect here, and not to be more sophisticated, and not to recognize that there isn't perhaps a need for us to have a bifurcated inflation number, is to basically not serve America. And I really mean not serve America, because if you're going to leave these rural areas behind, they come back and screw you, because they do control two senators, because they do, through gerrymandering, may control more House seats than they even should do. But because of the, you know, the salamander that looks like a, that's supposed to be a district, in a way, you are not only acknowledging the failure of how you set the inflation rate, but then that failure to acknowledge that has enormous consequences for the country. So that's why this article, I think, is so important. You talked about the fact that there's this basket of goods. So let's go through the basket of goods that the Federal Reserve is using to set the inflation rate. And let's then give people a sense of what they see in an urban setting versus what they see in a rural setting, because a lot of it is obvious, but you put numbers on what is obvious. And I think I always say that if you're going to run for office, you should always do the math. And what you've done in your article is you've done the math.
All right. We certainly tried. So just big picture here in terms of what is included in that basket of goods and services, that's going to be things like food and beverages, housing, apparel, transportation, medical care, recreation. We're going to be looking at all these different types of goods. And the method is to ask retailers and service providers across these urban areas how much these items are costing. And then we can kind of get a general sense of inflation and then calculate the CPI and then also have metro area specific CPIs. I think what's important for rural areas is looking at those expenditure categories and starting to uncover how they might be different. So one of the places that we look is at expenditures related to having a car and transportation. So having a car and driving is really essential in rural areas. Like you, I'm from a rural area, and you drive for everything. You drive for work, you drive to get daycare, you drive to get groceries, you drive to see the orthodontist. All of these things are often just further away. Especially work. Rural Americans are driving further and further, for they're commuting these long distances, often great further than 50 miles for work. So you have to own a car. So we see that car expenditures are greater in rural America. They spend about 12% of their expenditures go towards that car versus 7% in urban areas, for example.
Say that number again, 12% versus 7%. That's huge, everyone. So they're spending 12% more or 12% of their income?
12% of their expenditures goes towards
their car. That's repairs. That's buying the car. That's gas.
The outlay. So there's also going to be additional expenditures on maintenance, for example, expenditures on transport, on fuel costs. So on that owning a car, rural Americans are just spending more. And then beyond that, spending more on the car itself, as I mentioned, they're more likely to own a used car. And used cars, really, we saw dramatic price increases of that particular segment of the market in the last year or so. And so that adds up. You're spending more on the car itself. You're spending more on gasoline, depending on gasoline prices can be quite volatile, but we've gone through periods, recent periods, where it was quite expensive to
fill the tank. Gasoline tends to be more expensive in a rural area than in a competitive urban area. So I can drive in Derry, New Hampshire, and I can see a 20 cent difference, literally, between different competitive gas stations. But if I'm up visiting my daughter in Orford, New Hampshire, there is one gas station. And guess what? They get to set whatever price they want. So there is no competition. And I'm spending 20 cents more if I have to buy gas up there. So not only do they have an old car, which probably is more of a gas guzzler, we know the cost of used cars went up because of the pandemic. We know they're probably paying more for gas, and they're traveling more for work. But let me just say one other thing. I have huge regrets about not raising my children in Concord, New Hampshire, which is where I'm living now. Do you know why? Because I can walk to everything. Mm-hmm. I can walk to the bank. I can walk to the hospital. I can walk to the grocery store. I can walk to the school. When I had children living in rural New Hampshire, there was niente, nothing I could walk to. Everyone thinks, oh, in rural New England, in rural America, you get to have the great outdoors. You're more athletic. You're in better shape. No, you're not. You're in worse shape because guess what? You don't get the chance to walk, which is probably better for your heart and better for your health. You have to drive everywhere. And I would love to know at some point, I don't know if you looked at this, look at the sort of physical demographic of people. Not only are they older, I'm wondering if they're heavier in rural America versus in urban America. And that heaviness is in part because everyone assumes that they're probably working the back 40, but they're not. They're in their car.
Yeah, I think of my rural upbringing, and maybe by distance, we didn't live further from some of these amenities you just described, the bank, but it was a highway and county roads, and those aren't even the safest for walking. So even to the extent that you might think you could walk or should walk, if it's not safe, if you don't have the sidewalks, if you don't have the infrastructure, it's still just not as viable option in those rural areas. So the walking, the biking, the public transportation, all of those options are just going to make less sense or be less available in rural places.
One other thing before we get off the car shtick, and that is not only are they buying older cars, not only are they buying cars therefore that they need greater maintenance, they probably don't have the same fuel efficiency, all that stuff, yada, yada. But as my friend said, Arnie, I have a pickup truck. And I have a pickup truck because I do need to move bales of hay. But I don't have the option of buying two cars. So a little tiny efficiency like you with your little Fit that you know you drive around in, and me and my pickup. So when I do have to go to the grocery store, I have to take the damn pickup truck because it's the only vehicle I own. So he knows what he's doing. He understands why he's got this big truck. But he also recognizes I need this for my work, and his work could be, you know, cutting trees down or working the farm. But that then means that when he has to do the other things like I do, because I'm not doing that, it's costing him twice as much to get those groceries. So again, we're not always thinking, we're going, oh, look at him with the big truck, and then understand he needs it. What he doesn't have is an option. Oh, God. All right. Talk about this. I thought was absolutely fabulous. The rising cost of eating at home and traveling for groceries. Blow me away with a feather. The numbers that you showed there were actually quite surprising. Please share them with my audience.
Sure. So prices, food at home have gone up close to 12% versus eating food away from home. So eating out has gone up about 8%. And I think that's really relevant when we're thinking about a rural audience because they have fewer options for eating out to begin with. So these are people that are more likely already eating at home. Again, speaking from personal experience, I know we didn't eat out a lot growing up, partly probably because of savings, but partly because there just aren't a lot of choices in rural areas. So you're already eating at home. So people who maybe had been eating out, their natural inclination might be, well, I'm just going to switch. I'll switch to eating out less and I'll eat at home more. But rural people are already eating at home. And that cost of food for home preparation is getting relatively more expensive. So I think that when we see those differences in food prices, those really matter for rural people as they make their meals at home and have already been doing so to a greater extent.
You gave this interesting number about the cost of eating out has only gone up by 8.3%. The cost of eating at home has gone up by about almost 12%. And is that because eating out, they're willing to eat some of the cost of food preparation? What explains the fact that eating out hasn't seen the same spike? I guess, is it the competition? Is it that the management has decided, okay, we're going to get less of a profit because we don't want people not to come in our doors? Are they able to buy in a different setting? Therefore, the food prices that they're paying are very different from what rural people are paying. I was shocked.
I was surprised by that too. And I'm not sure I know exactly what's going on there. When we think about the pandemic, we did have these pretty dramatic changes in what was happening to the food system and how we distributed food. We had fewer people eating out at that time, more people eating at home. We've had a lot of negative impacts to food processing as they've tried to shift how they process, package, and deliver food. So I think part of this might still be related to adjusting to a bit of a new system. But beyond that, you know, it could be more competition in the restaurant sector versus less competition in the grocery sector. These factors can all contribute to maybe why one is shifting just slightly less than the other.
Well, again, we're talking about rural Americans aren't included in inflation figures. And for them, the cost of living may be rising faster. We got some of the numbers. It looks like they're rising faster. Mm-hmm. And we continue our conversation with Tessa Conroy. So before I get off the, you know, the cost of eating at home versus the cost of eating out, the other thing is that, so this is how I food shop. I will go to Shaw's for certain items. I'll go to Market Basket for certain items. I'll go to Aldi's for certain items. I'll buy things in Gross, yada, 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 yada. I have all these choices. Now I go back up to where my daughter is living up in rural New Hampshire, and she doesn't have choices, okay? Mm-hmm. She's got the gas station that has a little market next to it, or she has to make the schlep to another town for the only supermarket, you know? And then, of course, what her third option is a place you should never buy food, which is the dollar store. People don't understand. It's like, oh, they live in rural America. They're going to be growing all their food. They'll be, you know, milking the cow and, you know, killing the deer. But, you know, most folks are not actually doing that. And yet when you look at those kinds of choices, those choices by definition means they're paying more for food in rural America than they are in urban America, except everyone has this idea that this is where you grow the food. How come it's not cheaper?
Right. And again, I think this goes back to the food system, right? Most of the food we grow feeds into a very consolidated food processing sector and then out to grocery stores. Our food system isn't well organized for local distribution. And so we do rely on the gas station, the local grocery store, however far it may be. And we do see that rural audiences, rural residents are driving further to get to the grocery store than our urban residents. We're seeing rural grocery stores go away and to some extent being replaced by the dollar stores, as you pointed out. So the landscape for getting food just is different than what you might expect to see or even envision for rural America.
All right, now this is absolutely not surprising. The cost of growing old and ill outside of cities. So I'll share a little vignette. One of our former governors gave a speech up in Berlin, New Hampshire. It was the graduation speech for high school students. Berlin is a place that used to have paper mills. It doesn't have paper mills. You know, the biggest job opportunity up there is either working in tourism or, and now we have no snow, or working for a prison. Okay, we have the state prison and a federal prison. Oh, lovely, lovely. Anyway, but you know, it's a good job and it has benefits and, you know, you probably go to a doctor when you're sick. The question she asked was how many of them were going away or leaving Berlin for a job or for school. About 98% of the people said they were going to leave Berlin. Well, that made sense. For going to school, obviously. For finding a job, And then she said how many were coming home after they completed either their schooling or whatever job that they were going to get, perhaps to learn skills. Two were coming home. How do you survive? How do you live? And so then you've got this just incredible aging demographic with all the consequences of aging. And you kind of realize to get old is to get expensive. That's the nature of rural America, is that you're old and you're aging and you're sick. And the cost of healthcare doesn't get cheaper just because you live in a rural area. In fact, it's more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think it's more expensive, not just because, well, we see the rural residents are spending more on medical services, more on hospital care. And I think it's not just the services themselves, but the effect of cost, because again, that car trip becomes a factor. You're having to go much, much further. Again, we see rural residents traveling further to get to the nearest hospital than our urban residents. And so there is added cost through transportation, in addition to just spending more in general on those high prices, which I would attribute at least in part to, as you said, that older demographic, that as we get old, we have more health needs, perhaps greater needs for specialists as well. These can all add to costs and amount to rural places spending more on healthcare.
Well, and look at the number of rural hospitals that have closed all over the country. Let's be honest here. I mean, part of the problem is you might have been schlepping 10 miles to go to the rural hospital, and then they shut the rural hospital, and now you're schlepping 20 miles to get to the hospital because that rural hospital doesn't exist. Or that rural hospital doesn't have the specialist, and then you have to travel 100 miles to get to the specialist. Or, I mean, so when you start looking at all the variations on a theme, just don't get sick in rural America. But you can't say that to people because, like everyone else, you know, it doesn't look at your, sometimes it doesn't even look at your age or your income. You get sick. And the question then becomes, do you have access to healthcare?
Right. And here we're talking about the link with age, but anecdotally, we're seeing people having to travel further also for labor and delivery, also to see a pediatrician. So these services that we might have to hope to have locally and can be really integral to a quality of life in a place, they're just dwindling kind of across the board, whether that be pharmacies, grocery stores, or essential medical services. Rural Americans are just traveling farther to get to them.
Okay, now the last one is actually why I ran for governor. So you have to know that it was cheaper home costs, but heating and cooling may be expensive. I'm going to have you describe what you looked at, and then I'm going to tell you what you left out. Okay. Because this is my area of expertise. But explain to everyone what happens when it comes to home and energy.
In general, rural people are more likely to own their home. That can be a good thing when it comes to inflation because we have that set mortgage rate. So we're not seeing the same sort of price increases that you might be if you went out and bought a home today. So that could be good news. We also see that rural renters are spending a little bit less on rent. What we wanted to draw attention to is that there is this quality of housing issue. Sometimes in rural places, this housing hasn't been invested in or maintained very well. Sometimes this housing was built very quickly during a resource boom, for example, during kind of one of these expansionary periods, but hasn't been, again, cared for into the future. And so that can then amount to higher costs in terms of heating and cooling. And I would argue, as well as maintenance, perhaps, that can also get quite expensive to maintain some of these old homes. So okay. We need to draw attention to that.
Right. So one thing you did not include is that, so you live in rural America, it might be cheaper to buy a house. But guess what? You suddenly realize that your property taxes may cost more than your mortgage. And the reason is that we are so dependent on property tax to educate children. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when you look at the cost of education in rural America, it costs them so much more to educate a child than in urban America. So when you tack the fact that you are paying perhaps less for your house, but then when you add on the energy costs, when you add on the property taxes, guess what? It may not be cheaper. And then here's the kicker. So I've been talking to a lot of friends in rural New Hampshire, and it may not be true in every rural area, but it's becoming more true. As a result of the pandemic, a lot of people were suddenly able to live remote. As a result of the climate crisis, a lot of people are looking at where they live and saying, am I more vulnerable here be from fire or hurricane or rising sea levels? Where would I want to live? And all of a sudden, a friend of mine said, we can't live in our rural communities anymore because these flatlanders are coming in and they're buying our houses and they think, whoa, $120,000 or $80,000, that's cheap. And so all of a sudden they're competing and driving an $80,000 house up to $120,000, $120,000 up to $150,000. We could hardly afford the $120,000, he said. And so all of a sudden now they are being pushed out of their rural area because the competition is coming, both because people can work in a more bifurcated way, they can work remotely, or because they're leaving because of the pandemic, they don't want to live in a city anymore. New York City saw a huge number of people leave as a result of what happened during the pandemic. But that also becomes a problem because what was an affordable unit, you know, just 5 years ago, suddenly, even though it's in rural America, suddenly becomes more expensive because someone outside of rural America is now looking to purchase that. And that, I think, is also problematic. So it's forcing people to suddenly go, so what's the point here? All right, so Tessa, now that you've given me all these things to get depressed about, what do we do about this? How do we get the Federal Reserve to make a split number? How do we do that? How do we support people in those rural areas and recognize that they are different, that their burdens are different? How do we create a policy that says, you know what, inflation ain't the same everywhere, and if nothing else, let's try to be a little more broad brush in how we address it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a regional economist. I think about the economies of places. And the story that I think we're telling here is one about how it's important to acknowledge how places vary, right? That policy needs to acknowledge the local context. And I think that's important on a wide variety of questions. I think that's important when we're talking about the minimum wage. And I certainly think it's important when we're talking about inflation. So, elevating, raising the awareness of how these places vary and what effective policy is going to look like place to place, I think is really important so that we're conscious of making changes that are going to benefit households community by community and not just make it kind of a blanket change and hope that everybody's better off when we know that there are reasons why it's going to look different from here over to there.
I am the old politician in the family, and I keep looking at that red map. And I keep looking at the consequences of that red map. There are legitimate gripes here, everyone. They are affected differently from inflation. They did become the Rust Belt because a lot of those jobs, those former plants left. They went to Mexico, they went to Vietnam, they went to China. They are looking at the fact that they don't even own their farm anymore. The farm is owned by, Cargill. They don't even own their seed anymore. They can't even fix their damn tractor because they don't have a right to repair. On every level, they have been harmed. Ro Khanna talks a lot about economic patriotism, but economic patriotism needs to look at different parts of the country and realize that you need to respond differently economically if you want people to feel like they're part of a whole. So I'm grateful for your article. Again, Tessa Conroy is an economic development specialist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Her piece, send this to every congressperson you know. Rural Americans aren't included in inflation figures, and for them, the cost of living may be rising faster. Thank you so much, Tessa, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
In 2023, can abortion still be considered a constitutional right? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. As you know, the Supreme Court in 2022 in Dobbs overruled Roe v. Wade and erased reproductive choice as a federal constitutional right. But the United States Constitution is not the only constitution that matters. Every state has a constitution, and state constitutional rights can be broader than the federal, as was demonstrated in early January 2023 when the Supreme Court of South Carolina, 3-2, ruled that the state constitutional guarantee of a right to privacy includes a woman's right to choose. That decision struck down a state law that prohibited abortion after generally 6 weeks. Sadly, at the same time, the Idaho Supreme Court, also 3-2, ruled that under that state's constitution, abortion is not a fundamental right. The Idaho court upheld a state law that bans practically all abortions. One difference? South Carolina's constitution has a specific right to privacy. Idaho's doesn't. While the South Carolina decision shows that states can protect fundamental rights even when the Supreme Court won't, the Idaho decision demonstrates that state court decisions can come out very differently, and that fundamental rights or not.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not you since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
when it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And we continue to record on Tuesday morning. So a little bit of a backstory here. I ran for the legislature in 1984 on the whole issue of healthcare. That's why I ran, 1984. And the reason was that I was working three part-time jobs and none of my part-time employers provided me with health insurance. And guess what? I got pregnant. And therefore, because I didn't have access to healthcare, I basically had to treat my body like a temple. I had to pay out of pocket. And I wasn't worried about me, but I was worried about my child. I wanted to make sure that she was healthy. But I was really ticked off because I was working over 50 and 60 hours a week, and yet I couldn't benefit from group health insurance, and I couldn't afford, you know, out-of-pocket health insurance. So when I ran for the legislature in 1984, I gave birth a week before I won my election. I did, however, have insurance by that point in time. But more importantly, I was committed to something that began to look at what do part-time workers need, that full-time workers need, that every worker needs. They need to be able to go to a doctor when they're sick. And I believe that healthcare is a right, but at least I was going to start by crawling. And my first piece of legislation, which actually passed despite a veto by Governor Sununu, as in John Sununu, we actually reintroduced it the second year, was by requiring private insurance companies to not discriminate against part-time workers for the purposes of participating in group health plans. So the employer could make that decision, but not the insurance company. And it turned out the insurance company had this rule that if you worked under 30 hours, you could not participate in a group health plan. We were the first state in the nation to actually do that. Now, why am I telling you this story? Because I eventually ran for governor and I ran wanting something more like a single payer. Of course, I lost, but the idea was a great idea. I've always recognized that health is so important that you have to be able to access health. That the idea of going to a doctor should not matter whether you have a job or not have a job. It shouldn't matter whether you're 2 years old or 92 years old. And that the idea of sort of investing in all of our health was not only good for families and good for communities, it was good for a country. I've belonged on occasion with a group that looks at single payer, but there is a group in my state that's entitled the Granite State Physicians for a National Health Program. And just last week, I was introduced to two pieces of legislation that were going to be offered to the New Hampshire legislature. But one of them I thought was so fascinating, and I wanted you to hear about it. And it's based on a Maryland model that's been in effect, I believe, since 2014. It turns out to be actually quite successful. Hallelujah. And I thought, well, you know what? If it's good for Maryland and New Hampshire's introducing it, then I want people in Texas and I want people in North Carolina and I want people in Wisconsin to pay attention to this conversation. Joining us is the person that testified before the New Hampshire legislature. His name is Ken Bulkhart. He's retired from Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center as an assistant professor of medicine. He now practices part-time and enjoys teaching at the Geisel School of Medicine. He received his undergraduate medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania. He provided primary care for 35 years in internal medicine and geriatrics in New Hampshire. He developed practices in HMOs and PHO settings and has worked with ACO, what does that mean, and academic settings. Anyway, post-retirement, he practiced in Guatemala and Dominican Republic, and he remains active with the Granite State Physicians for a National Health Program. Welcome to the program, Ken, and what does ACO stand for?
Thank you, Arnie. It's an accountable care organization.
Oh, I've never heard of that, an accountable care.
It's a modification of HMOs, and actually Vermont is trying to use the ACO model for a all-payer system, which is not what we are proposing here in New Hampshire, and it's not what Maryland does. Okay. So of interest, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm glad I asked the question, what is an ACO? Because it was an acronym I was not familiar with, and I'm hoping to become more familiar with it. You spoke to this group in a Zoom session, and then you spoke to the New Hampshire legislature. And it was on a bill that's numbered, or you don't care, but you may want to look it up, New Hampshire House Bill 319. And it proposes an incremental step with an all-payer finance plan for hospital care. And as you mentioned at the meeting, it was based on the Maryland model. So I decided that, you know, I needed to understand it. You talked about the Maryland model. The model's been around since 2014. And I wanted to sort of see, okay, now that it's, you know, 2023 and people have had a chance to actually experience this model for really quite a long time. When you're talking about healthcare, this is a significant long time. And let me just start with the exclamation point at the end of our conversation, and then we'll go back into explaining what exactly this bill does and why other states may want to consider it. So I read this article, and it was entitled Meaningful Value-Based Payment Reform. Maryland Leads the Way. That was the title of the article. I went, oh, this is exciting. But let me read you this sentence, because this sentence, just I could not wipe the smile off my face. The evidence is clear. Maryland's application of uniform prices within global budgets for hospitals lowers total care costs, reduces unnecessary utilization, and incentivizes proactive prevention and chronic disease management. Oh my God. Went through first base, second base, and third base, and they were heading home. So Ken, as I read that sentence, I'm like, you better explain this to me. I need to understand it. I want to explain it to a lot of people, but I don't just want New Hampshire folks to understand it. I want folks nationally to understand it, Ken, because I don't think we're going to get Jack, you know what, out of Congress, in part because of the House. But that doesn't mean that states can't be these great experimenters and they can't show the way as to what works. And if it's going to work for one state and it works successfully, like we're seeing in Maryland, then these kinds of successful models should in fact be cloned. And right. If they can be cloned, then maybe we can begin to crawl to goal as opposed to sprint to it. Explain to my audience exactly what is an all-payer finance plan for hospital care. It sounds like it's over my pay grade, but I need to have you bring it down so I understand.
And your pay grade is pretty high, Arne. You have a lot of sophisticated knowledge about health policy and health economics. So maybe for a varied listening audience, I could just back up by introducing a little bit of what people already know probably, which is U.S. healthcare costs are twice that of any other developed nation. And despite those genuinely doubled costs compared to any other country, our longevity is less. Our performance in preventing death from easily preventable illness is less, and clearly our health equity lags far behind that of other countries. So that's the background. And this was not always the case. There's some more history here. The U.S. health costs and systems becoming corporatized really began after Ronald Reagan's deregulation of healthcare. If you were to look at a chart with the lines of the chart reflecting U.S. healthcare costs compared to other nations, you would find the line for the U.S. healthcare costs growing from year to year in a shallow incline, basically nestled right with other nations. All nations were contending with advancement in technology and improvement in medical care, et cetera. It's striking, if you look at that same graph, we jump outside of that pack. We leap inches above the rest of the world after the deregulation of medical care.
Yeah. So what is it that Ronald Reagan did to deregulate? Yeah. Give me two or three examples of his deregulation so I can embrace. I was always frustrated with Ronald Reagan. Now I need to know why I'm really frustrated with Ronald Reagan.
Couple things. You and I are old enough to remember when our parents had Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Of course.
That covered most Americans. It was actually one form of insurance. Guess what? It was strongly regulated. It was nonprofit, but more important than that, it was community-based with community prices, and it allowed for physicians to be paid by Blue Cross Blue Shield, just like Medicare pays physicians, but it did not inflate costs for profit. What happened with Ronald Reagan's deregulation of healthcare, you've heard of, remember the HMO and the debacle of the HMO in the 1990s, when your gatekeeper would prevent you from having care, your pre-existing conditions, which the ACA did away with, would prevent you from getting service for your previous medical issues. What happened, HMOs were actually a government experiment, health maintenance organizations, managed care, was a government experiment to keep down costs and improve the quality of care by accentuating and incentivizing primary care, that is, preventing illness rather than more expensive treatment of illness once it developed. Ronald Reagan said, yeah, HMOs are great. Let's profitize them all. So the government had previously said, no, if you're going to be an HMO, it has to be nonprofit. A certain amount of money has to go to quality of improvement. And you have only a minimum amount of medical loss ratio that goes to profit. The Ronald Reagan perception of the world is that everything fits a free market model. And in reality, there are certain things that don't fit a free market model. Utilities, energy costs. Remember all the smartest guys in the room from Enron? Who turned the energy markets on their head to make a profit from it. They made basically tons of money out of air. Right now, you have private equity doing the same with our tax dollars going into Medicare, Medicare Advantage, ACOs, which are not a good thing in this context, by the way. So what happened with Ronald Reagan is he allowed private equity, this is Wall Street traded corporations, to make money off of healthcare, not just from premiums from employers, from employee-sponsored insurance, but now from our taxpayer, our payroll taxes going to Medicare in the way of Medicare Advantage. The insurance companies, the American health and insurance programs, AHIP lobbies, are now running government. They control government over what can be done and what can't be done. It has flipped. Remember, Ronald Reagan, there's a terrific recording of Ronald Reagan railing against Medicare in 1964. The AMA hired Ronald Reagan to be their spokesman against what they called socialized medicine back then, that seniors have come to depend on. It's actually one of the most popular forms of medical insurance is Medicare. It's dependable. You pay your premiums. You've paid costs into it. What happened in the late 1980s.
And it's portable. We can't forget the the reason I mentioned portability. The portability is that Medicare Advantage is not portable.
That's correct.
Medicare is portable. At some point, we're going to have you back to talk about Medicare disadvantage. I want people to understand
different
that.
Different conversation.
But the portability is so important, especially for seniors who want to like be snowbirds. Maybe they want to go to Florida or Arizona, but they live in New Hampshire. They live in Vermont. Or they travel to see their kids. And then suddenly they realize they're on Medicare Advantage. And what they thought they had, which because the word Medicare is used in both terms, that it would be portable. And it turns out that it's not. So all the liabilities of the private insurance is now attached to Medicare. It just sucks. Okay, so now we got Ronald Reagan. He did this deregulation. We have all these problems, and we see the cost of healthcare just going through the roof.
Right. So we have pricing failure. The reason our healthcare costs are not because Americans get more hip replacements than people in Japan and Australia and Europe and anywhere else on earth. We actually get as many as they do, but not more. They get just as many MRIs. If you're on any other developed nation on earth, including Costa Rica, you're getting MRIs. It's the cost of these things. The pricing is four times as high in the US as it is elsewhere. If you have a hip replacement in the Netherlands, you pay $17,000. The US, it's going to be, who knows what it is now. Every time I look, it's $10,000 more. It's like $90,000, $60,000, something absurd. So we have, because of the absence of appropriate regulation and greed, let's be clear, avarice, if you can get away with it, and that's your mission statement to make a bigger profit, you will. So you're taking a public good, which you mentioned, a critical aspect of living is to have healthcare, and you've now converted it into a growth industry that has really altered our ability to afford healthcare and kept down our wages, by the way. So if you look at inflation for paying for premiums. If you're a worker and your employer covers healthcare, great. It's 257% is the inflation over the past two decades in terms of what you're paying for premiums. Similar numbers, 200% for the deductibles. So you don't even get anything for having paid your premiums when it comes time to pay for medical care. You're still paying off those $1,000 or $5,000. That far outpaces inflation. What's the consequence of that? Our wages haven't gone up. because they're all getting diverted into paying for your employer to pay for the healthcare.
This makes me scream because I keep reminding people. So the cost of your energy bills have gone up in New Hampshire, for example, 100% when it comes to electric bills, almost the same when it comes to your gas bills. The cost of your property taxes have gone up, the cost of your maintenance, but your paycheck hasn't gone up, but you're feeling so good because they're still covering your healthcare. Yeah. Well, here's the bad news. You're probably not using your healthcare more this year than you were last year. You still have access to healthcare because you have a health insurance package that's in part paid by your employer. The piece that you live with, which is your paycheck, doesn't move. But the piece that the employer says, oh, but I'm spending more on health insurance. Well, guess what? It's not really benefiting you because you're not getting strep throat more often. You're not breaking your arm more often. I mean, I want people to know, I want you to be able to go to a doctor when you have strep throat. That's almost running in place. That insurance piece and the piece that you need that can't run in place is your paycheck, but your paycheck has stagnated because the employer is saying, but I'm diverting all those additional costs into health insurance. And yet you are not, even as a family, necessarily benefiting from that, although you want the security of knowing that you do have coverage. I mean, I think people, they need to look at what they live with and what they're paying for this insurance plan, which, you know, is a good thing, but it doesn't feed the family.
It's an extraordinary phenomenon, Arnie. Oh. Over the past 20 years, we've seen a feeding frenzy of corporations and their CEOs basically siphoning off our taxpayers' money, by the way, as well as our wages, into the pockets of CEO executives.
Right.
Basically, this 1%, the disparity of what people are making in private equity while people are struggling to afford their health care. It has really been a crisis that is coming to fruition, by the way, in terms of outcomes and what we can manage in this nation. The HMOs back in the 1990s ran the show. There is private negotiations between every insurance company, Humana, Aetna, or Cigna, or United Healthcare. They all individually negotiate behind closed doors, not publicly, with hospital executives to decide how much a hospital will get paid by that insurer for a particular service. So if you're going to have an appendectomy, this is what you pay our anesthesiologist, this is what you pay for the OR time, this is what you pay for the hospitalization. It is different, proprietary. Nobody knows what you're paying with each of one of those insurance companies. And when you have your appendectomy, you don't know what your bill is going to be until you get it 4 weeks later. And how much of it will reflect various of these basically opaque negotiations. Well, what happened is hospitals got smart after the 1990s. After HMOs were running the show and they dictated in those negotiations, this is what we're going to pay you. Hospitals figured if we expand and we have more covered lives that we are responsible for, we could start dictating to the insurance company, hey, you want to take care of our 100,000 patients in our catchment area that we take care of? Guess what? We're going to tell you what you're going to pay for that appendectomy or that colonoscopy or that invasive procedure, et cetera. So basically, it flipped. And hospital prices, as a consequence, and hospital revenues, these are nonprofit hospitals, increased at 4 times the rate of inflation over the past decade. That's the past decade. What has happened is hospitals have also competed with one another to improve their reserves. Remember, these are not paying, these hospitals don't pay taxes. They're nonprofit, but they sit on billions of dollars that they can invest in the market or in Caribbean startups or whatever. This is what's happening. This is a reality. So they have realized also that they make their money on surgical subspecialties. Mm-hmm. For instance, most insurers, private insurers, what we just mentioned, United Healthcare, et cetera, there is a disparity in how much they pay above Medicare prices. Medicare sets the benchmark, the standard, mm-hmm. but then insurance companies want to incent people to get their insurance. And what they'll do is they'll pay more for subspecialty procedures and surgery. For instance, they will pay up to 330% over what Medicare pays for that total knee replacement or your bronchoscopy or subspecialty procedures. However, when you go to see your doctor to manage your diabetes or to treat your hypertension or to discuss whether you want to get that colonoscopy or to have a conversation. How is your depression affecting how you're taking care of your diabetes? Those are considered cognitive services. They don't make 330% over Medicare prices. They make nothing over that, or maybe 10% at most. There is a reason that we're seeing primary care in the state of New Hampshire get decimated. And yet you see all these ads for total knee replacements and to get your bypass surgery. So instead of there being incentives to meet with your doctor to discuss, let's talk about your cholesterol, your diabetes, and your high blood pressure so you don't need to have a bypass surgery. The incentives are, okay, let's get that bypass surgery. This is where you want to go for it. That's where they get the revenue. It is a system that is money directed. It's avarice directed. It's profit directed. It's not directed at a medical system, which other countries long ago have figured out. You incentivize primary care, your population stays healthier. So when you have your lead screening, you have your immunizations, you have your hypertension screening, you have your management for all these chronic diseases, that all these chronic issues that can result in preventable chronic disease, you have a healthier population.
So it's tell me how this global budget that Maryland is doing has lowered total care costs, reduces unnecessary utilization, incentivizes proactive prevention. How do we do this? Because I want to do this.
So what happened is Maryland was far ahead of the curve. By the way, it goes back to the 1970s. So they had been doing this for five or more decades. It's harder for state. Pennsylvania, by the way, is implementing all-payer global budgets for rural hospitals, which keeps them in the mix. So what, and remember, John Hopkins, that's an academic medical center. There are top-notch big player hospitals in Maryland. Over many years, they have come to trust this process of open, sponsored negotiation between all the private insurers I mentioned and the hospital systems. It's not just the private insurers. They have waivers from CMS, from Centers for Medical Services, which is, by the way, announced that they're going to be giving more waivers for this purpose.
This is the waivers for Medicare and Medicaid.
Correct. Okay, so that so that a particular hospital negotiates with a state process, state open, and it's public. It's done openly. The prices are listed. They determine a single price for that appendectomy, whether it's Humana, Healthcare, United Healthcare, Aetna, Medicare, or Medicaid.
Oh my God.
Pay the same price for that procedure. What happens for a lot of hospitals, they don't want to take Medicaid. It pays far 50% of what they're getting from the private insurers. Right. So why would they want to take a patient to the OR to get a knee replacement when they can make, you know, twice as much when it's a private payer? What Maryland figured out is we can put all payers on the same stage. On par. So hospitals are more incentivized to take patients with Medicare and particularly Medicaid. They don't lose money. They stay relatively whole because what they're losing for the additional funds from the employee-sponsored insurance, they get from Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
And hospitals, interestingly, have done very well in Maryland, better than elsewhere, because they've been insulated from this necessity for pouring out more fee-for-service widgets. When nobody was going to the hospitals during the COVID pandemic, they were insulated because they were still getting reimbursed based on their experience from the previous year. Wow. They had global budgets. And guess what? Those global budgets benefit rural hospitals. That's why Pennsylvania's introduced all payer for this segment. Rural hospitals are typically where I work these days, seeing patients who are from what we call Rust Belts. The manufacturing has left these places. There isn't a lot of employee-sponsored insurance among their population. There's patients on Medicaid who maybe are probably working, and Medicare. They don't have what's called a payer mix. They go under because they can't afford to, this also happens in inner city urban areas as well.
I've lived your story. So I told you I had my first baby born without health insurance, okay? But my second baby was born with health insurance. And I had my second baby in a rural hospital known as Cottage Hospital, because I was delivering with insurance at Cottage Hospital, I actually heard people saying, she has insurance. She mm-hmm. has insurance. That was what people were saying in the hallway, everyone. Understand this. It was such a rare phenomena. It was Medicaid because it was a poor area. It was Medicare because it's rural and old. It was hard to keep people to stay at those hospitals. That's why, for example, Don Kolish and Pat Lauer, who were my doctors, were working at a clinic in Monroe in order to even attract them to come and serve in a rural hospital. Can you imagine? It's 1984 and they're actually running up and down the halls going, she has insurance. So your story about this global budgeting for hospitals is so important because we're seeing the closing of rural hospitals. Yes. That is a bad thing. That means that you have to travel farther and farther to get to a doctor.
Absolutely.
It means that you can't be serviced in a community. You can't grow an economy if you don't have a hospital. And then I'm going to end with this, Ken, and you've got to come back and talk. I remember when Berlin was losing all its paper mills, and the mayor, the Republican mayor of Berlin, was begging the feds and the state for what? For prisons. They wanted the federal prison and the state prison. And people are saying, why would they want a prison? Because they paid them decently and they had something that was important. They had health benefits.
Yeah.
And it was their health benefits that kept those hospitals open in Berlin. We've been talking with Ken Dalkart. He is brilliant at what he talks about. We've been talking about the incremental step for an all-payer finance plan by looking at hospital care. We're looking at the Maryland model. The model worked. We're hoping it's going to be introduced in New Hampshire and passed in New Hampshire. But states all over the country, look at this model. If it can prevent and reduce unnecessary utilization, reduce total care costs, and incentivize proactive prevention, you need to consider it. Thank you so much, Ken, for doing this.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You may-